discussing the ideas, the challenges, and the technology of the crypto economy. This is a Crypto Economy Chat. Welcome back, crew, to the Crypto Economy Podcast. I have got a Crypto Chat episode today. It is not to be missed. We have Vijay Boyapati on the show. If you do not know him, you can find him on Medium and Twitter at real_Vijay. He's a key Bitcoin maximalist to be following in the space. He's incredibly knowledgeable, well-versed, and an advocate of Austrian economic theory. He has a bunch of writings on Mises.org that you can check out. In fact, actually, his Medium article, when he started releasing the parts of the bullish case for Bitcoin, he released in four parts originally. It actually had a hand in convincing me to do this show. It was one of those things that I read, and I immediately thought, man, this needs an audio version, because I knew a whole lot of people who would really, really enjoy it probably were not going to get an opportunity to sit down and read it at length. So I did that one on the show after he released all four parts. That's episode 21. I definitely encourage you guys to go back and listen to it if you have not done so. And so I just want to thank Vijay for coming on the show. In this episode, we discuss everything from his history as an engineer at Google, him standing up against their censorship practices. We talk about the recent pushback against Bitcoin maximalism on social media and what it might mean. We hit monetary theory and whether altcoins or central banks and governments are a threat to competing with Bitcoin. We talk about the coming BCH fork that's coming up. Is Bitmain burying themselves in this mess? And is fiat money doomed to be a stain on our history books? So I know my listeners will enjoy this one. Vijay always has some really insightful and awesome things to say. So without further ado, here is our crypto chat with Vijay Boyapati. All right. Well, welcome to the show, Vijay Boyapati. This is, for anybody who doesn't know, Vijay is at real_Vijay on Twitter. And if you're not following him, then you are not winning at Bitcoin. He is the Bitcoin maximalist's maximalist. And in fact, your article was, I think the first time I had stumbled upon you was when I read your article, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, which was awesome. It's like one of the very earliest things that I did on this show, because it was such an awesome piece. But you used to be a engineer at Google, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And just wanted to say,
how long were you with them?
I was with Google from 2002 to 2007. But I wanted to say thank you for the kind introduction, and I'm sure Pierre Rochard would take exception to what you said about being the Bitcoin maximalist. But I can duke it out with Pierre later.
All right. Sounds good. And make sure you record it so we can hear it. All right. So, since you were an engineer at Google, I know, see you post on Mises.org. I stay pretty up to date with their stuff. So I see stuff by you up there every once in a while. What kind of have you been doing since then for, you know, whatever you want to get into?
So I'm a lot of my time is spent thinking about Bitcoin and learning more about it and reading about it and writing about it. But I have to admit, most of my time is taken up by my kids right now. I have two young kids, and obviously they're the loves of my life. And I have to spend a lot of time on them. So I don't actually have much free time right now. But the free time I do have, I spend a lot of it thinking about Bitcoin.
Cool. How old are your kids? Actually, you got two.
Two and a half and 10 months old.
Oh, wow. You got a baby, baby.
Yep.
Oh, you got dogs going crazy in the background. Give it a second here. All right. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. So let's go ahead and let's jump in. I wanted to talk about, just because you used to work for Google and you've been posting a number of things on Twitter that I thought was really cool about what's going on, because there has been kind of a surgence of censorship and controlling what people see in a major way on all these social media platforms, really just in the last couple of weeks. Like, it's always seems to have been a minor problem, but it seems really blatant recently. With you having worked at Google and the recent, announcements or recognition of their project, quote unquote, Dragonfly, where they are trying to create a censorship a search engine to release in China, I kind of wanted to get the main points that you had talked about on Twitter that I thought were really, really good points to make, and kind of your thoughts on that whole unfolding that's been going on.
Yeah, sure. So I was an engineer on Google News, and in around 2005, Google entered the Chinese market with its search product, which is its main product, and I guess is still its main product. But it wanted to expand its product offerings in China, so they decided to launch Google News in China. And I was asked by my manager to work on the launch of News in China. And when I got the requirements, it was pretty clear that they wanted me to build a bunch of features that would allow the Chinese government to censor news in China. And that made me feel really uncomfortable. Particularly because there had been no internal debate at Google about the fact that we were going to censor news in China, or the extent to which we would censor news. And the requirements were actually very, very stringent. Things like removing whole sections of news. There would be no world section. There would be no business section. And if there was any story that China didn't like, we would have to remove it within 15 minutes. And so I got up at an engineering all-hands meeting and explained what was happening and why I thought it was wrong and why I refused to do it. I had told my manager I wasn't going to do it. And they replaced me on the project and put someone else on it. But yeah, it has new relevance because Google appears to want to enter China again. And I think without a strong moral voice at Google, the profit motive, the temptation to chase profits in China is massive because their market is massive. And I think that temptation is going to be too strong to resist. In 2010, after first entering China, Google left, and it's largely attributed to Sergey Brin, one of the co-founders at Google, who had grown up in the Soviet Union and so had suffered under an oppressive regime when he was a kid and was well aware of what those regimes were like. And so pressure from him ultimately got Google to leave China. But Sergey doesn't have as much influence in day-to-day decisions at Google anymore. So without that strong moral voice, my guess is that Google's probably going to continue on this path, and it's going to enter China, and it's going to comply with their requirements, and it's going to launch a censored version of its products over there.
Interesting. That's a pretty ballsy move. Were you nervous kind of standing up and being like, you know, I'm sorry, I can't do this?
Yeah, I was worried I'd get fired actually. And so, you know, I tweeted that I hope that people at Google now will stand up and refuse to work on this product. But I can also understand why people would be reluctant to do it because you're really risking your career if you do something like that. And so it was definitely tough. And I'm, in a way, a credit to my manager and Google at the time. I wasn't fired. They let me stay on, even though I said I wasn't going to work on what they asked me to work on. I mean, it's still a job, right? And when you're asked to work on something, you typically expect that you should, otherwise there's going to be consequences. And I think at first my manager was upset at me because his job was to get something done and he hadn't really thought about the morality of it. But after I stood up at the engineering all hands meeting, I remember him being more understanding of my position. So I appreciated that.
That's really cool. Yeah. That's major props that you did that. And particularly when it got you moved off the project. That's a tough decision to make. But you know, I can also see the opposite is if you went forward with it, you'd end up hating yourself for doing it. I know I would. It'd eat me. Absolutely.
That's a really good point. And that was probably my main reason for refusing to do it, because I thought what I imagined was there would be some journalist in China who wrote about something controversial, like the Chinese government cracking down on its people or something of that nature. And a journalist would write about it, and then the Chinese government would come to us and say, hey, you need to remove this story immediately. And we would remove the story, and then something happened to the journalist. And I personally just was horrified at the thought of building something that could make that possible. So it really, in a way, is self-preservation. I couldn't live with myself if I built something that did that. So in a way, you could say it was a little bit selfish. It would be really hard to do something like that and see the consequences of it and then suffer that, you know, forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that has been such a huge problem. And I feel like just the idea of censorship and the lack of freedom over information, and then obviously finance. I mean, it's the reason Bitcoin exists, and mm-hmm. And it's what makes Bitcoin so powerful in the context of what's the changes that the whole world is going through over the past 30 or 40 years and is continuing to accelerate into at a breakneck speed. It seems to be constantly on the edge of being completely out of control. But do you see any, like, I have like watched very closely because this is such an important, something that's so dear to me. Like, do you see a solution to this? Because with all of these major platforms getting more brazen about deciding what people should and should not hear or see, have you seen any project or anything specifically that you see as like a possible scalable solution to this issue that we can kind of get some of that communication, freedom of communication back?
I have seen some projects, and there's one I do want to talk about maybe a little bit. The real problem, though, is that there are huge economies of scale in running businesses like Google or Facebook. Mm-hmm. When you get all those users, you have a lot more insight into their behavioral patterns and the things you need to optimize for that your competitors don't have that information. And so because of those economies of scale, you now have a few gatekeepers to, you know, a very large fraction of people's interaction with the internet. So they have the power to censor what they deem is inappropriate. And it's a very troubling situation. There is one startup in Seattle that I think is pretty cool called Privacy Labs. And a shout out to that startup. I met with their co-founders, and I think one of the cool things that they're doing is they want to build more of a decentralized internet where each person owns their own data, and so it's not held on Google or Facebook. And so they sell you a little device which makes it really easy to manage your own emails and manage your own files and things like that. And but it still has some of the nice properties of these applications like Gmail that make them so convenient to use. And it's still very early stage, but I like that direction. And I think as people become more and more concerned with the loss of their privacy and with how much information is being controlled by these large companies, I think there'll be a trend towards people searching out solutions like the one that Privacy Labs is working on.
Interesting. So it's a hardware device.
It's a hardware device that you might buy, like in the same way you'd buy like an Apple TV or something. You set it up in your home and it lets you have your own email account that will communicate with other SMTP servers and send email and allows you to manage your own data. So I sort of see it as a replacement of Gmail and perhaps Dropbox and I think ultimately they have grander visions than that. But even if they were able to do only those things, I think that would be a huge win. Having control of your own data and being able to communicate with people without an intermediary like Facebook or Google is a very powerful thing. So I'm looking forward to seeing their products when they come out and hoping for their success.
Interesting. I've definitely noted them down. I'll keep an eye out for that. That's a really interesting term. I've seen tons of people trying to build software solutions, but to have like kind of a plug and play device that just kind of does all that. I mean, that was one of those ideas very early on in the internet that everybody was going to run their own email server and own all their own data. And then it turns out we all just logged on to Google. And
yeah,
so that's a really
interesting. Because it was so much more convenient.
Yeah,
yeah. It was just, and if someone could, you know, provide a decentralized solution that was convenient, that would be fantastic. And I think there'd be a lot of demand for that.
Well, that's awesome. I have to put that on my list of gadgets to buy here. All right. So let's jump into Bitcoin maximalism, because that's been a bit of a hot topic on Twitter lately. It kind of always is, but more so recently for some reason. One of the arguments I have heard that is that there's a lot of reasons Bitcoin should have to worry about alternatives or threats to its kind of monetization. And one that kind of stands out and keeps coming up is that it will encourage the fact that it has a solid monetary policy, will encourage other, you know, central banks, governments, and such to compete. And there will be this race to have the strongest money, essentially. How do you see that in the realm of risk to Bitcoin if everyone ends up, whether it be businesses, governments, or central banks, start trying to compete by having a better monetary policy than Bitcoin?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one important thing is to understand where Bitcoin lives in sort of the monetary hierarchy. And it's important, I think, to understand that Bitcoin isn't really competing with banks or payment systems or things like that. Monetary systems are always built in layers, and Bitcoin is aiming to replace the base layer, which is the dollar, and, you know, in the past was gold. That's the most trusted layer, and it's the layer in which the settlement of all transactions eventually happens. So in the same way, it's sort of the same way of saying that gold does not compete with Visa or MasterCard. And gold, by the way, has a much, much larger market cap than the entire payments industry combined. But Bitcoin does compete with central banks, and central banks are providing that base layer of the monetary system. The final settlement happens at the central bank. So, you know, when banks settle each night with each other, they have various debts and credits between each other from people who use their services transferring money back and forth. They're essentially settling at the central bank, saying, you know, Chase is saying, we have this many debits and this many credits with Bank of America, let's settle our account with them. And they do it at the Federal Reserve. But the problem for central banks, though, is that I think they fundamentally reject this ideology of sound money, or sound money as we Austrians understand it. And they believe that they have a role to provide a so-called stable monetary system by inflating the monetary supply, the money supply, sorry. And I think they just don't really understand or believe in something like Bitcoin, which is a fixed monetary supply. That's why I don't think they'll be able to compete with it. They're just ideologically opposed to it. And so it's not something that they can compete with directly. They're just taking a completely different ideological path.
Yeah, I would, like, in the way I see it, particularly with central banks and governments, is it's almost kind of antithetical to why they would be needed anyway. Is that if their role is to just set a secure monetary policy and do nothing, which, as you say, is kind of the opposite of their whole ethos, then why would you want a private resource governed by a specific group of people that could be attacked or fall victim to corruption, as opposed to I can't remember his last name. The guy who testified in front of the banking committee recently, mm-hmm. He called Bitcoin a public resource. And I thought that was a really, really interesting way to put it when he was using that term multiple times in his little testimony about Bitcoin being a public resource that just anyone has access to and literally no one owns. As soon as if we get to a point where central banks and governments are trying to compete with that, I feel like Bitcoin already won. Like, if they have to change everything about how they operate to accommodate for the fact that Bitcoin is kind of throwing their fallacies in their face, it's like, do we really have anything to worry about? And that's like the best problem to have, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would certainly be beneficial if it started to change the monetary policy of central banks around the world to be a little more sound. But it's interesting that you mentioned that we don't really need central banks if we, you know, have Bitcoin and it's widely adopted. That was the viewpoint of Milton Friedman, who's a Nobel Prize winner in economics. He thought that the central bank could be and should be replaced with a computer, that although he didn't quite subscribe to the fixed money supply, he thought there should just be a computer which inflated the money supply by a fixed amount every year. And he thought that that was superior than, you know, the constant manipulation of interest rates. And so Bitcoin pretty much satisfies that property. It's a network whose protocol gives you a very predictable inflation schedule over time. So I think if Milton Friedman was still alive, he would see Bitcoin and think this meets his criteria, something which is a worthy replacement of central banks.
Yeah, that I know of a video specifically where he says almost that exact thing is like in the 90s or something. He talks about like if one was just done by a software program or like a, you know, a mathematical schedule, that it would be preferable. Milton Friedman was actually a big reason I found Austrian economics at the beginning, even though I now don't agree with many of his thoughts on money. He was a big reason of me finding Austrian economic theory at all, in the beginning.
He was a big influence on me too. And despite some of the things that I disagree with, I still think he, was a great spokesperson for the importance of individual liberty.
Mm-hmm. Most specifically, just because he kind of had that Ron Paul feel about him. He was just always calm and always in control. And some of his arguments were just beautiful. There are a couple of snippets that I will still go back and watch just because it's just the most sound argument I've ever heard put so perfectly that it just gives me tingles. Okay. So there's back to Bitcoin maximalism. There was another couple of arguments that I read like two pieces criticizing Bitcoin maximalism very recently. And another one was that later entrants into this space, like maybe during the next hype cycle or whatever, will not want to enrich Bitcoin early adopters. They'll basically resent the people who got into Bitcoin early, and the cult of Bitcoin maximalism will push them away. Do you see this as a problem? Is this something that you think hinders monetization? Like what?
I don't think so. I think there will always be some who will be resentful over the prescience and success of others, but really there could be no fairer means of distribution than that was created by Satoshi. He publicly announced Bitcoin before the network began, before he started mining. And anyone has the ability to mine by just downloading the software, which is freely available. And Satoshi, who has by far the most coins, also disappeared and very likely has relinquished all of the coins that he mined in the early days. None of the coins that he mined have ever moved, despite the fact that they're worth billions of dollars. So I don't think there could have been a fairer way of distributing the coins. Some people are always inevitably going to see these opportunities before other people. The narrative really is no different to someone who had the foresight to invest early in Google or Facebook and reap the benefits of seeing an opportunity early. And also, I want to point out that I think we're really, really early in the history of Bitcoin. There's still a massive opportunity ahead of us, and everyone has the ability to go out now and buy some Bitcoins, and I think people should go and do it while it's still feasible to get even a single Bitcoin. I don't think the opportunity is over. I don't think people should be resentful. If you want to be resentful, just be resentful for yourself, for convincing yourself that this is not an opportunity you want to pursue and believing bad arguments.
Yeah.
Go find, read as much as you can, learn about it. Go find the good arguments and educate yourself. And if you've found that the things that you've read convince you not to buy Bitcoin and it eventually becomes money, then take responsibility. It's your own fault.
Yeah. On that, do you see any in the whole altcoin space? Because there's plenty of crap out there, but what do you see, anything that has an interesting level of decentralization or maybe privacy or secure in any way, like at the base layer, that stands to compete with Bitcoin at this point?
In my opinion, nothing comes close to the security or network effect of Bitcoin. I mean, not even remotely close. However, Bitcoin does have an Achilles heel, which it's not perfectly fungible. And the problem is that the Bitcoin blockchain is completely transparent, and governments and corporations can track the movement of Bitcoins, and they could potentially pressure exchanges or businesses to not accept so-called tainted Bitcoins, like Bitcoins that had been used in sort of illicit trade, like buying drugs, for instance. But it's important to understand that at the network level, Bitcoin is perfectly fungible. Every Bitcoin can be transmitted equally, even if it's a tainted Bitcoin or not. So the network doesn't see any difference between them. But Bitcoin is weaker at the application level, which means that you could potentially have Bitcoins get stuck at places like Coinbase, because Coinbase says, hey, we've detected that this has been used in illicit trade. And I should say, most $100 bills have been used in illicit trade as well. So this isn't specific to Bitcoin. But my point is that Bitcoin lacks some fungibility at the application layer because of its lack of privacy. I mean, you can try and be really careful in how you acquire your Bitcoins and not give away your identity, and that can help. but I think Bitcoin definitely needs improvement. And this is one area of opportunity for other coins, in my opinion. However, there are major, major trade-offs in privacy versus performance. And I think it's better for these trade-offs to be explored in coins for which immutability is not such an important trait. I think that's the most important trait of Bitcoin, that it's very, very hard to change. It means that no corporation or government can come along and say, hey, we want Bitcoin to be something else and we're going to change it. So Bitcoin's very, very hard to change, which means that that's a property that we should really protect. The community as a whole should try and protect, which means I think we should all be very, very cautious about making changes to Bitcoin, such as adding privacy features. I think you'd need some fantastic improvement to privacy to be used on some other coin and tested over a long period of time before it would be worth adding to Bitcoin. And I think, you know, the privacy features of coins like Monero and Zcash and things like that are interesting, but I just don't think they're at the stage where they're suitable to be incorporated into Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah, particularly with both the Zcash and the Monero privacy are both heavy in computation at the same time. So there's a pretty big trade-off still with what's going on. And I think as far as I heard, Monero has a limitation with scripting, if I remember that correctly. I might be wrong. I might be wrong about that. But one that I'm holding out hope that we get privacy through just kind of a myriad of different innovations at like within the whole stack of stuff. Like we get, you know, Neutrino coming. I think Lightning will be a huge improvement for that. I can't remember which developer was talking about trying to make CoinJoin transactions the default for making Lightning channels. And then there's Wasabi Wallet. I mean, if there's anything I talk about on the podcast, more any single topic I talk about, it's either Lightning or privacy takes the cake.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that you're bringing up, which is that even if Bitcoin lacks privacy features at that base layer, it's possible that those features could be added at higher layers. And that's certainly preferable. What you want at the base layer is stability and immutability. And wherever you can build improvements without, if you need to make improvements that would require changes at the base layer, it would be preferable to do it at higher layers in the stack.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that got me more excited than anything else about privacy, was when I've been reading about like just signature aggregation and combining that with the fact that we want, not only is it a trade-off that's deliberate and completely necessary to keep the system decentralized, but the fact that there's a block weight at all, that there's a, you know, spam limit essentially at the base layer, makes data management so important and economical. So when we can aggregate signatures with something like Schnorr, or the BLS scheme that has come out that's very similar to Schnorr, where it's just basically one signature all the time, regardless of the number of inputs. The fact that they can all, that it's economically cheaper, that there's actually an incentive to be private, whether or not you want privacy. I think that's a huge kind of incentive switch for the whole problem that I'm fingers crossed goes to basically making CoinJoin and signature aggregation a standard. And, you know, the private transactions are completely indistinguishable from the rest, essentially. So I have a lot of hope that we will get there. At least everything I'm following gives me a lot of hope. And there was a long time that I was worried it was just going to be limited to some specific altcoin like Monero or Zcash, you know, whatever, Mimblewimble, maybe.
I think we have a, you know, a very long time horizon to figure this out. I don't think there's a huge necessity to figure it out immediately. I mean, it would be great in the future when Bitcoin is adopted as the global reserve money for people to be able to transact privately. But I think that's still a long way off, and there are many, many different avenues that engineers can go down to figure this out. So I'm not worried about it yet. And I just think it's the biggest weakness of Bitcoin. And it's certainly the area in which the most research should be directed.
Yeah. Luckily we have a lot of people on it. That's good news. Okay. Where am I in my thing? So this was one thing about the multi-coin argument that does get me. And it was something I read recently actually kind of backed that up, because I go back between being a back and forth between being a total 100% Bitcoin maximalist to being like, maybe there's going to be a handful of these things and Bitcoin is just a dominant player. And there's two main pieces. There's the pie chart of the protocols that we use on the internet. And then there is one that there is always a software risk. And because money, the thing that I read recently was saying that money is a hedge against future uncertainty, that it's because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, that you want to hold the most liquid asset possible in order to basically have insurance against that uncertainty. And software is a different mechanism than something like gold that has like real properties, you know? And the CVE bug recently kind of brings all of that into attention, that the thing really could just kind of collapse one day. It remains a possibility. Do you think that stands in the way of having a single monetary standard despite the kind of Austrian incentives at play?
Well, I agree with you on your first point. Even when gold was, global money, silver still maintained a relatively small monetary role.
Mm-hmm.
And the way markets with strong network effects work is that there's a dominant player that takes 90 to 95% of the market, and the other 5 to 10% is divided amongst everyone else, and typically second place gets most of the remainder. But I'm only really interested in the 90 to 95% part. I'm not that interested. Like if I was an investor, I'd be much more interested in finding the next Google in the search space rather than worrying about whether I should have like some of my money in Dogpile or AltaVista or whatever other, search engines that have now bitten the dust. But the other thing you said was also really interesting, the bug that came up, and it's important to realize that Bitcoin is trying to be a new monetary system or a new base money. The software sort of helps make it work, but it's more than the software. What's really important is the consensus of the people who are using it. And it's not, I don't think these bugs are actually quite as scary as people make out, because if there is a bug and someone says, hey, actually, there's a bug that could potentially create a fork and one chain, the supply could be inflated without any restriction, then the consensus of the people using the software would be to just ignore that chain and go with the chain where the bug was fixed. The real risk is if there's a bug or someone discovers a fundamental flaw in the building blocks of Bitcoin, in the cryptography. These more superficial bugs, I think, can cause like speed bumps in Bitcoin's path to monetization, but they're not going to stop Bitcoin, because ultimately the consensus around Bitcoin will choose the chain or the path that where the bug is fixed. But if someone discovers, or you know, we quantum computing actually happens, and we find that the cryptography can be easily broken, then it's a problem. Then Bitcoin will probably face a real crisis. But I think a little bit much has been made of the bug that came out recently, as if it was like a potential Bitcoin killer. No, it wasn't. It wasn't a Bitcoin killer. Bitcoin had a even worse bug in the early days, where anyone could spend anyone else's Bitcoin, and they had to do a hard fork to fix it. And obviously, the chain on which that bug occurred, if anyone continued mining on it, no one would care about it or use it. It would just die. Yeah. So my point is that it's more than just the software. It's the agreement of the people who use the software.
Gotcha. That's a great argument. I like that. What do you think the biggest barrier is currently? Not necessarily down the road or 2 years ago. What do you think right now is the biggest standing in the way of Bitcoin being adopted as a widespread money?
Let's see.
Obviously, there are many.
I think that's a good question. I think the biggest barrier is just inertia and time. People who haven't dealt with an economic crisis like Venezuela or Greece perhaps don't understand the importance and the urgency of building a new monetary system. The other problem, I think, is the user interface. I think that's a pretty big issue. It's still pretty complex for people to understand how to acquire and safely store their cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin in particular. If you lose the keys, you literally lose the assets, and there's nothing else like that. So imagine if you lose the keys to your car, and your car literally vanished from the universe and you could never get it back again. You would be a lot more stressed about your car keys. And so there's definitely that element to it, making it easier for people to secure their bitcoins is a problem that I think needs a lot of work, and the user interface aspect of that too.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of things. I constantly try to test out like all the new software and stuff, particularly like key management, because I have tried to, not only tried, but I have walked many people through the process of hardware wallet, like setup. And it's so funny how quickly you forget what the average person's perspective is when you consume this stuff all day, every day. Like, I will sit down with people and they will look at me like I am speaking Chinese. And I'll go through the whole process and just realize how many things that I'll say 10 words and 8 of them were words that they may have never heard. So I think you're right. That's just the whole nature of how to interact with it. And then, you know, not even knowing like why everybody's used the dollar. It's worked great for how many years for these people's entire lives. What do they have? What reason do they have to want a new money? So I think you're right. Those are really good main issues that we're dealing with at the moment. There's also a lot of fallacies, just complete falsehoods. So I'm curious what your favorite is. Is it that Bitcoin will boil the oceans, or that it's only used by terrorists, or you know, whatever druggies? What's your favorite Bitcoin FUD?
Yeah, the idea that Bitcoin is a waste of energy is one that I think is definitely one of the bad fallacies out there. But there are other people who have dealt with that pretty well, and so I haven't spent too much time writing about it. But the one that has really irked me the most is the economic fallacy, which is that money is primarily defined as a medium of exchange. And this fallacy is pervasive in modern economics, and it's the single most harmful idea in crypto, I think, because it causes so many people to think they should be treating Bitcoin as a payment system or as a medium of exchange, or that that's what it should, you know, immediately aspire to. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin is not a payment system. It's a replacement for base monies like the dollar or gold. And the fact that people have put such a strong belief in this fallacy have caused whole communities to split off from the main Bitcoin community and pursue things like Bcash. And I think the failure of Bcash to get any adoption is because of this fallacy. It's not, money evolves in stages, and the first stage is it's a collectible. It's something that people just are curious about and they hold it just because of a personal whimsy. And then eventually, if there's enough people like that, it starts becoming a store of value because people recognize that there are enough people who will value it and take it from them in exchange for other things. And then eventually, you know, once enough people view it as a store of value, its purchasing power will stabilize. And so Bitcoin's purchasing power through its history has just skyrocketed. And so it's actually quite irrational to exchange Bitcoin for other things and relinquish your Bitcoin. But eventually, when enough people hold it, you know, a few billion people hold it, its purchasing power will stabilize. And then it will become suitable for the medium of exchange role of money. And eventually, once it's widely used in that role, it will become a unit of account. So it's this fallacy that money is a medium of exchange and Bitcoin is a medium of exchange or should be a medium of exchange that I think has caused so much trouble. And it's really like trying to jump to something before, like trying to run before you can even walk or crawl. You need to start with those steps first. And I think Bitcoin, of all the cryptocurrencies, has a community which believes in this and understands this. It's the people who don't understand this have pursued other paths and I think ultimately are going to fail in the path that they've chosen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. That is the... There's so much of the every time I have a debate with somebody about that or conversation, it does seem to boil down to that, which I find a lot of people who ascribe themselves as Austrian economists still seem to adhere to that belief that, you know, it needs to be a payment mechanism or a medium of exchange right now. And I kind of like your analogy that it's skipping step. It's like trying to turn TCP/IP into trying to build Netflix on top of it before you got basic messaging worked out, you know, like it's you can't measure a house with something before you've got a measuring standard kind of thing, you know?
So, yeah. And the problem is that if you look at any economics textbook, they define it this way. They say, because the question of what is money is a very complex question. Money is something that changes over time and it evolves. And if you define money as a medium of exchange, that's how you start and you define it, then you wash away all the other things that are characteristics of money. And so it makes it very hard to understand what money is. And I really blame the economics profession, and it's a definitional problem. If you look more deeply into money and don't start out by defining it in a certain way, then you'll understand that it has other characteristics, and those are just as important, if not more important, than the medium of exchange role of money.
Yeah. You know, on that, since we're kind of talking about Bcash already, you had that epic tweet that I want to get back to one question, but I think it might be good to hit at the end. So your tweet thread about the Bitmain IPO and all the details going on with that, I still have not dug heavily into that, and I haven't read anything on the podcast about it. So I assume that my listeners don't know anything about it. But you hit a bunch of really big points in that that got me is like, wow, like this could be a really, really, really bad thing, a bad situation for Bitcoin Cash. So why don't you kind of give a brief overview of that whole fiasco?
Sure. Bitmain is the largest mining company in the crypto space, and they recently announced their IPO. And one of the interesting details that came out of their IPO filing was that they had sold all of the Bitcoin that they had mined over the last several years, which was a very substantial amount of Bitcoin, and they had sold it all for Bcash. And the reason they did this is they made a strategic bet that Bcash would be much better for them as a company because they would largely control it, and because they didn't like the direction Bitcoin was heading in with transactional uses happening at the second layer rather than on the main Bitcoin blockchain. So they were worried about the enabling of SegWit and that would make Lightning Network possible. The problem for them is that the market had no interest in Bcash and its price completely cratered. So now they're holding a massive position in a highly illiquid good. They're the biggest holder of Bcash by far, and they can't possibly sell their position without destroying its price. And they've already suffered huge losses on their Bcash position. Their purchases were a way of trying to create credibility for that altcoin in the market and trying to get people to believe it would replace Bitcoin. They even had the temerity of calling it Bitcoin Cash, which I think is stupid. It's Bcash. It's pretty similar to how failed states prop up their currencies by selling their foreign currency reserves to maintain a price level. So in this case, their currency, foreign currency reserves were their Bitcoin position, and they're trying to prop up a failed currency, which is Bcash. And eventually, these pegs always fail if the market does not believe in the credibility of the currency. And Bcash has no credibility whatsoever. You just need to look at the clown show their community is. People like Calvin Iyer and Craig Wright and Roger Ver, they're buffoons. These people don't know what they're doing. And like Craig Wright claims he's Satoshi. If you've ever heard Craig Wright speak, he's completely incoherent. So the credibility has been destroyed by the people who have sort of taken over this community, and it's reflected in its market price. So that puts Bitmain in a really bad position. They're going to IPO and they're sitting on already substantial losses, and they have this huge, huge position in Bcash, which they're not able to sell. So really, I think the IPO is a way of untangling themselves from this situation. If they can have an IPO, then they can bring liquidity into the company, which they really need. They're desperate for liquidity because mining operations are very capital intensive. They require the building of huge factories, chip foundries, securing power. So they need a lot of liquidity, and a lot of their savings are in this very illiquid good. So they're in a bind, and it's unclear how they're going to untangle themselves from this.
Yeah, that quote that you the thing you mentioned just a minute ago, when I saw that one in the whole tweet thread about the state trying to prop up its own currency by selling the foreign reserves, I was like, ooh, that one is on point. It's a scary situation because they, God, they could the amount that they're holding. Do you happen to know the percentage? I feel like it was a. I don't remember it off the top of my head. Do you happen to know
I
the
think
percent?
when I looked at the numbers, I think it was somewhere in the order of $1 billion worth of Bcash, which is a very, very large
Oh.
fraction of the total supply. If I'm not mistaken, it's as much as like 8 or 9% of the total supply of
Oh.
Bcash. So the problem with having such a large position is, how do you get rid of it? How do you
Yeah.
sell it to anyone? You need to find people who are willing to take it. Because if you hold that much and you sell it on the market, and there aren't enough people who believe in its credibility, then it's just going to completely tank. So they're holding a very large bag and they're in trouble.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that now Craig Wright is just actually there's a couple of developers right now that are because they're trying to hard fork in something, and I think a developer recently just said that they were going to back out of the project if they did this. That now that they've dedicated themselves to just hard forking every 6 months or whatever it is, they've trapped themselves in this endless political battle, and now they're going to end up with a forked coin that with two illiquid coins, and they're going to be holding Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin Satoshi's Vision or whatever it is. It just the whole thing is kind of crazy.
Yeah, and I think the it's interesting you brought that up. I think the forks that are happening are an inevitable consequence of the fact that the Bitcoin Cash, the Bcash community rejected immutability as one of Bitcoin's core properties, and they felt very comfortable forking away from Bitcoin. And if you live by the sword, you're going to die by the sword. And I think the upcoming fork of Bcash could be the end of that shitcoin. Because it, if you have a contentious if you have a contentious hard fork where the community basically essentially evenly splits, then you have all these difficult problems like, well, which one gets to be called Bcash? And the exchanges get very scared because it's not clear to them which one which chain they should label Bcash. And typically what happens is exchanges just shut down trading in the coin until something happens, and that's like that's the moment of gravest extreme for any cryptocurrency is when all trading shuts down, because that's when you could potentially see a no bid situation where the market completely collapses and people are like, wait, this thing I can't even trade it, so it's not worth anything anymore. It really it destroys confidence for a market to shut down. So forks can be very, very damaging, and I my guess is the fork that happens to Bcash in November will be very, very damaging for that coin.
Yeah, if that actually happens, I mean they're going to be thrown back into their hash rate problems again too, which took a hard fork to even sort that out. So they're going to probably end up with hash rate swings, and at the same time, both will immediately be far more susceptible to any sort of an attack. Since that whole thing came out, the more and more I look into it, the hairier that whole situation seems to be. So I guess we'll see. It's right around the corner now. Get
Yeah.
to see what happens. I wanted to ask just to kind of get your thought on this. The do you see fiat money is actually not like even I've been reading going back through the Bitcoin standard a little bit recently, and even old money, even money that was managed by governments, 500, 700 years ago, inflation was incredibly slow, and that the statistic in that in the book that really just opened my eyes, because I knew a lot about hyperinflationary periods, but I had no idea how relegated to one period in history hyperinflation was. I didn't quite realize that when kings devalued their coins and gold coins, 1,000 years ago, it happened really slowly. It happened over 50 years. But today, in the fiat money era, it's only been in like the last century that 56 of 57 recorded periods of hyperinflation happened. So do you think that we're getting close? Do you think that Bitcoin kind of marks the beginning of the end for fiat money in general?
Yeah, I tweeted about this a while ago, and I described it as the fiat money interregnum, which interregnum is a word which means the period between the reign of two kings, and the two sound money periods which sort of bound this fiat money interregnum are the gold standard, which was a sound money period, and the Bitcoin standard, which I think will eventually. We will eventually see that. So yeah, I think we're living in this kind of bizarro world right now where it's sort of widely accepted that governments controlling money is a good thing, but I think our posterity will look back on this and think how insane it was. Like how did we ever believe that it's a good idea to put money in the hands of politicians and central bankers and look what they've done to our money.
Yeah, I think when we look back, it'll be slavery all over again. It'll be all those things that we see in history. They're just like, how did nobody see it? You know, like the massive, just flood of problems and corruption that it bred. But you know, what's your time frame, you think? I mean, this total just blanket speculation. What do you think your time frame is on Bitcoin, kind of where fiat money, even if it exists, it's pegged with Bitcoin or you know, whatever cryptocurrency?
Well, these things can happen much faster than you might imagine, but I'm generally a pretty conservative person, and I'm thinking in terms of 50 years, and I certainly hope I live long enough to see it. It would not surprise me if something like this happened in a shorter time horizon, say 20 years, maybe even 15 years. But it will be resisted quite strongly by central banks and by nation states. So I would rather stick to the conservative side and say 50 years. And I think, you know, if Bitcoin exists 50 years from now, which I expect it will, it's going to be massively more valuable than it is now because people's trust in its existence and its existence into the future will be much, much higher than it is now. Bitcoin's only it hasn't even really existed a decade yet, and so the confidence that it's going to exist into the future is not as high as it's going to be in the future. But I think if you give it one more decade, I think people's confidence that it will continue to exist will be significantly higher than it is now. And I think that's sort of similar to in the way that people now, the internet as we understand it has been around for say, let's say 20 to 30 years. People just assume it's a permanent feature of the world. They can't imagine a world where the internet is gone. You know, my kids are going to grow up and assume that it's a permanent feature of the world. There are people like me who are kind of older who remember what the world was like before it, who might imagine what the world could be without the internet, but the longer it exists, the more people will believe it'll exist forever. And there's actually a term for this called the Lindy effect.
Yeah, the Lindy effect, the more something has survived or like has continued to exist, the more people perceive that it has a long life ahead of it. All right. Well, we're kind of getting to the end of our time. Did you have anything else specific you wanted to add?
Go buy some
Got something to chill?
Bitcoin. I got something to shill. No, I'm always happy to shill Bitcoin. Go read about it. Go learn about it. And I guess maybe my other comment was I really appreciated your reading of my article. It was I've never heard something I've read so written read back to me, and I thought you did a really great job of that.
Great. Thanks, man. I'm glad to hear it. I know when I started this whole thing, I read a lot to my wife, actually. When she would do something, we'd just sit down and read books, and I just got used to reading it out loud. And I just thought there's so many articles, there's so many great things like the bullish case for Bitcoin that I know. I mean, it took me 1 hour and 15 minutes to get through it. And I just know there are so many people who would love to read it, who just don't have the time to sit down and do it. Thank you so much for the article. I mean, I just read it out loud. you're the one who wrote 1 hour and 15 minute bullish case for Bitcoin. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, dude, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been fun.
Yeah,
We
for
got to do
sure.
it again sometime.
Yeah, I'd love that.
All right.
Thanks,
Well,
Kevin.
thanks, man. Take
Yeah.
it easy, dude.
Bye.
All right, guys. Thank you for listening. Thank you again to Vijay for coming on the show. This was a really great one, and we had a bit of trouble trying to get it scheduled. So I'm glad we finally got around to that, particularly when I make the mistake of forgetting that there might be a 4-hour time difference between us. So that made it interesting, but we got it all sorted out. With that, guys, don't forget to follow him on Twitter at @real_Vijay. And you can find him on Medium as well. I will link to his Mises.org page, his Twitter page, and his Medium page, so you can find him in all of those different places and dive more into his work. And also, don't forget to follow me at The Crypto Economy on Medium, Mastodon, and Twitter. And now you can find me on Instagram at Crypto Economy Guy. I have yet to set up my thing to automatically post up there, but I've kind of enjoying the interface, just kind of browsing, so it might be a really good fun it might be a fun one to start expanding to. So check me out up there. I might have some fun stuff, and I got a lot of announcements coming up within the next couple of weeks. Hopefully I'm finishing up some things that I've been working on for quite a while, and so, you know, stay tuned, guys. Stick with me, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you would like to support the show, I now have an Amazon affiliate link. So if anybody, I know everybody uses Amazon. I use Amazon constantly for practically everything these days. It's almost embarrassing how much I rely on them to get stuff. I plan on having links to buy products that I actually use all the time. The one that I've got up on the website right now, and that's at cryptoeconomy.life. Is just to start off, is just a link to buy Mastering Bitcoin by Andreas Antonopoulos. I read a little bit of it, at least a couple of pages every single night. I'm about 2/3 of the way through it now at this point. And it is just packed with everything you would possibly want to know about Bitcoin. So that is an easy one to put on the website, and encourage you to go buy if you do not have a copy of it. Support Andreas Antonopoulos and our show at the Crypto Economy Podcast at the exact same time by getting your Mastering Bitcoin book off of cryptoeconomy.life. And I'm going to be putting up stuff that I use all the time specifically. And so if you're just curious about, you know, what I do, the books I read, and, you know, all that good stuff, that's where you're going to find it, on cryptoeconomy.life. So check that out and follow those affiliate links and support the show and, you know, read, listen to, and use the stuff that I use. So hopefully that'll be a cool way to help get some funding here for the show to keep this thing alive without costing you guys anything out of the ordinary. And I also have my affiliate link for Trezor still with, if anybody's trying to get their hardware wallet, you want to use that affiliate link. It sends a couple of bucks to me without charging you a dime. And of course, I will have my Bitcoin donation address available for anyone who would like to support the show with a little bit of Bitcoin to help keep my coffee mug full and keep these episodes coming. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. This was a really fun one, and I hope you all enjoyed it. I will see you all back here tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.